important to us over the years. So I feel thankful that we were asked to do our story. I didn't feel thankful yesterday. I always find preparing for these difficult. But I do feel thankful because it's a chance to think back about what God has done. And sometimes you forget these things, I think. So I'm going to start with just a little bit of an overview of my early years. And then Kate will talk about hers and then some verses that have been meaningful to us. I'll just pray first. Thanks, Lord, for this opportunity to share our lives with other people. Thank you that it's wonderful to be known by other people. And often these sorts of details don't really get spoken about. We don't always get a chance to tell our stories. So thank you for this opportunity. And I just pray that as we speak, as Kate and I tell these stories that, and we share these verses with our family, I guess, these other people who believe in you, that you will be glorified, that people will hear something that they can apply to their lives. They just get to know us a bit better, Lord, but please be glorified through what we say in Jesus' name. Amen. So I was born in 1981 in Morocco. I was actually born in a town called Meknes. So Morocco, for those of you who don't know, if you can sort of have a, I don't know if you can imagine Africa in your mind. I can. So Morocco is top left of Africa on the Atlantic and Mediterranean coasts. And my parents had gone there in the 70s, I think. Yep, in the 70s. Dad went there as a, not as a missionary, because missionaries weren't exactly allowed there, but I think they're called tent makers. People who go there, go to another country to tell people about Jesus, but not with an actual mission group. And he went as an English teacher. And my mom actually did go with a mission group, but she went to teach English as well. So I'm the eldest of four. We're all fairly close together in age. And until I was seven, I lived in, well, almost eight, lived in Morocco. So if you don't know, Morocco is a Muslim country, and it is, it's probably a more relaxed Muslim country than some. Saudi Arabia is the home of Islam. I lived there later, and that's much stricter. But Morocco is kind of westernized. They speak French and Arabic. But you still hear the prayer call five times a day. So I remember growing up hearing the guy calling out the prayer. You could hear it all around the city I lived in Oujda, which is where I lived laterally in Morocco. And lots of little memories, I suppose, but one thing that really stood out to me growing up in Morocco was that you don't just drift into becoming a Christian. One of my earliest memories was of a baptism we had, and it was a young guy. He seemed old to me at the time, but he was probably in his early 20s, and his name was Ramzi, and he decided he wanted to get baptized, and so we met at the St. John's house. That was the name of the family's house that we met at. Some of you may have read Patricia St. John's books, so it's one of her nephews happened to be that guy whose house we met at, and we had this baptism for Ramzi, and I remember thinking he had none of his family were there. It was just him, because by following Jesus, he was leaving everything else behind, but he wanted to do it. It was important to him, and I think he liked karate or some sort of martial arts. So he had his white martial arts uniform on, and he got into the bathtub, and we baptized him in the bathtub. And and I remember everyone singing, "I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back." So that really stuck in my mind. That's an important memory for me. When a Muslim becomes a Christian, they leave everything behind. And it's something that can't just sort of happen. It has to be it really focuses the mind to know that you'll face persecution, you'll face trouble and hardship if you follow Jesus. The other story was when I was about 5 years old, we had lots of people coming to our house, but one older Moroccan gentleman came to our house and he was making me a kite. And that was pretty exciting, and he hadn't quite finished it. But he had to go away traveling somewhere. I don't know where he went. And we later heard that he'd actually been taken to prison by the police for being a Christian and ultimately died in prison. And I remember my dad telling me that story. So these little memories that I have of being a Christian in Morocco were really formative. And I think that's a blessing, because I think sometimes in countries where it's okay to be a Christian, where you're allowed to be a Christian, you don't see such a sharp, I guess you don't see how difficult or what a difficult decision it is for some people to become Christians. It wasn't difficult for me at that point. I was just seeing this. I guess God was allowing me to see these things. And the other thing that I suppose was formative about growing up in Morocco was that I wasn't Moroccan. I could never be Moroccan. You have to be a Muslim. I was born there, but I wasn't from there. And my dad used to sing to us in the evening and play his harmonica. That's an early memory tune. And one of the songs he really liked a lot was Poor Wayfaring Stranger. Do you know the song? I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe. But there's no toil or fear or danger to that bright world to which I go. So it was always a sense that we are, I think Barry spoke about it last week, that we are strangers passing through, that this is not really our home. We don't really belong. Like, we moved to Saudi Arabia later on as a family. I didn't belong there. Then eventually, when I was a bit older, I moved to Montana, which is where my mom is from. And even though I looked like I could be from Montana, I still didn't really feel like I fit in. So you could see that as a negative, but actually for me it was a positive. It was good to remember that we're strangers passing through. We don't belong here. We're citizens of heaven, not of earth. So at about age 13, I was living in Saudi at the time, I remember I'd always known about Jesus. And I think if you've grown up in a Christian family, you can identify with this. But I remember lying in my bed, staring at the ceiling, about age 13, and deciding that I needed to make a decision for myself. And so committing to God that I was going to follow him too. It wasn't just my parents, but it was going to be me as well. And that was important. I'm sure God didn't forget about that. But you don't, sometimes you make a decision and you don't fully understand the decision you're making. I think especially, well, for me, growing up in a Christian family, I knew all about Jesus and I knew about sin and I knew about my need for God and my need for salvation. But I think maybe I hadn't experienced for myself what God's grace meant. So I would say I probably drifted away from the Lord a bit in the subsequent years. Not completely, but in my late teens and early 20s, I went through a patch where I was really struggling with sin that made me feel like I was a fraud and that I that made me feel distant from God. And then sort of when I finished university in Montana, age 21 or 22, can't remember, I went to live in Gateshead to get married to Kate. We had known each other for a while. And during that year, that first year in Gateshead, I really felt like I discovered God's grace in a way that changed me, probably age 21, 22. So it was those two experiences, and I'll go into a bit more detail later on, but those two experiences, age 13 and then age 22, really feeling that God had changed me in a way I couldn't change myself, and that I finally really understood what that word grace meant, which I'd heard over and over throughout my life. So that's just a little bit of an introduction to me, and Kate's up next.
Hello. So I was born in Scotland, for those who don't know me. I was born in the Shetland Islands. That's where my parents were living at the time, on a little island called Wallasey. And we left there when I was two. So most of my growing up years were in Dingwall, a town just north of Inverness in the Highlands. My parents are Christians, and I'm really grateful that when I was growing up, they made it clear that following Jesus was the thing in their life. That was the central thing they were doing. Dad was a policeman, and Mum was at home with us kids. I'm the sixth of nine children, and my parents also fostered various children when I was growing up, and when I was 11, they adopted two Brazilian orphans, and there were always a lot of people at our house, a lot of people dropping in. And my parents are really good at talking with people about God. They did a good job of caring for people and showing their faith in practical ways. They're just, yeah, they are very genuine about their faith. They still are. I was seven when I first realized I had a choice in whether or not I would follow Jesus as well. It was just something that had always been part of my life, and now I was really confronted with the fact that I actually had a choice to make too. It's funny when you think about people who are seven, sometimes you can underestimate what's going on in their head. We were at church having communion time, and it just hit me what it really meant. We'd done it so many times before. I'd been there all my life, as long as I could remember. But I'd never really had it sink in about what this was about. Later that night, we had a little booklet at home called Journey into Life. Some of you might remember it. I read through that at home that evening. And I really understood my separation from God, my sinfulness, my need of a savior, and that Jesus had died for me. When I look back at the time I spent in church as a child, I realize how good God was to me, that there were older Christians who cared about me, encouraged me to be involved. And there weren't a lot of Christians my own age, so at the time I didn't necessarily think that was a good thing, but looking back, I think it was amazing how it let me interact with all these other people. As I got older, I repeatedly made that same decision that I would follow Jesus, and that was going to be the thing I was building my life on. I particularly remember a time just after I'd left high school. I'd been over for the first time to New Zealand to visit my big sister who was living here. And then I'd stopped in the Philippines and Malaysia and was volunteering there for a couple of months. And it was the first time I was on my own. Nobody knew me. I didn't know anybody. And it was kind of a weird feeling, realizing that I needed to decide who I was going to be when no one else was there. I felt so aware of God's presence with me and that I belonged to him, whether my family was there or whether I was just by myself. After that year, I moved to Newcastle in the northeast of England to go to university, and I studied medicine. Again, I was in a place where I knew no one. And again, God cared for me and provided me with good friends, everything I needed, a church family to belong to. So having told you a few things about my life up till the end of university, the next big thing that happened was that Rab and I got married. I haven't mentioned him in my story, although he was there. We first met when we were 10 and he came to live in Dingle for a year. It's where his grandparents are from. And they were some of the people that were really encouraging to me when I was growing up. So back to Rab to share a verse.
So I alluded to that experience that I was having just after, around the time I got married, and feeling that I knew for the first time what grace really was. And the verse that really stands out, so we're going to try to now talk about verses that have been important to us. We have four. The verse that really stood out to me is in 1 Chronicles chapter 17, and it's verse 2 of chapter 17. I think it might be in somewhere in Kings as well, but basically it is the story of David and Nathan, hence the name of our first son, Nathan. David has got to the point where he has settled, he has his own house. He says he's living in a house of cedar. And he calls the prophet Nathan, and he says to Nathan, listen, here I am living in a beautiful house, but the Lord is still in a tent. I feel like I should do something. I want to build a house. And Nathan says to him, whatever you have in mind, do it, for God is with you. And that's the verse that really stood out to me. Whatever you have in mind, do it, for God is with you. And I just got the feeling like Nathan was saying to David, listen, God is on your side. Do whatever you do, and I'm sure God will be happy. Now, if you know the rest of the chapter, you know that Nathan comes back the next day, and he says to David, I've had a dream or a vision. And God says, no, actually, don't build the temple after all. Someone else is going to do it. But I still think that first verse where Nathan says to David, whatever you have in mind, do it, is like the essence of grace. That's kind of what it's all about. Because although God said to David, no, don't build the temple, someone else will build the temple, he was really happy with David having that impulse in his heart. You know, I'd heard often as a kid that David was a man after God's own heart, and I'd always been interested in what that meant. What could that mean? It sounded good, it sounded interesting, but what did it really mean? And I think this was a glimpse into that, that David wanted to do something for God. He felt like, well, here I am, blessed, I want to bless God back. And the cool thing about that verse, that chapter, is that God says, no, hey, listen, good idea, but actually I'm going to build a house for you. Nathan brings back this incredible prophecy and this blessing for David. David tried to be good to God, and God said, I like the idea, but no, I'm going to bless you instead. And after Nathan tells David what's going to happen, all this blessing that God is going to bring through him, it says in that chapter, then David, King David, went in and sat before the Lord, and he said, who am I, Lord God? And what is my family that you have brought me this far? And you just sort of get a sense in that passage that he's overwhelmed. Is this God's goodness is too much for him? It's kind of like he's saying, why me? Why would you choose to exalt me in this way? And then David goes on and he says, and as if that weren't enough, you, O Lord, have looked on me as though I were the most exalted of men. And I love that. You've looked on me as though I were the most exalted of men. And I believe that's somehow true for each of us who know the Lord. I think in some very real way, I know that David was pretty special, but I think in some very real way, when we experience God's kindness, each of us can say that God has looked on us as though we were the most exalted of men or women. And that's, I think, what it means to experience God's grace. Around that time, so this verse connects with a story in our life. Around that time, we were leaving the north of England where we lived. We were living in Newcastle or Gateshead. This verse helped me to understand something very important about the way I could relate to God. That I think Michael referenced it when he was reading from Hebrews about how God can cleanse our consciences. And up until that point, I had been feeling guilty about the way I was living. I was aware of my sin, and you could say I was living under the law, but this transformation, this change in the way I was thinking, gave me a new sense of sort of joy and peace and happiness about the way God saw me. And it gave me a freedom to act and not have to be sort of super worried that I was doing the wrong thing or that I might be not doing the will of God. If we try to live according to the law, we can never be quite sure if we're pleasing God. There's an uncertainty. In fact, we know we aren't. There's an uncertainty about our relationship with him. We'll be second-guessing ourselves, always wondering if we're understanding God's will correctly or accidentally offending God. Grace changes that. The Spirit of grace can say, whatever you have in mind, do it, for God is with you. It really flips everything on its head. And so that verse gave me the courage. When we had decided after a year in Gateshead or in Newcastle that we were going to leave and we were going to go to New Zealand. But on the way, we were going to stop in Saudi Arabia, where my parents were still living, and visit with them. So we both quit our jobs. Kate had finished her job at the hospital. I was working at a call center, advising teenagers over the phone and online. And we were staying with a friend because we'd moved out of the house, and we put any stuff that we wanted to keep with a friend in a friend's garage. We had our bags packed because we had this feeling that although our airplane ticket for going to Saudi was still 2 or 3 weeks away, that we were somehow meant to leave before then. But there were a number of things stopping us from going, because you need a visa for Saudi Arabia and you need a visa for New Zealand as well. And my passport was in London. We were up in the north of England. Our ticket was for 2 weeks away, and we didn't have a visa for either New Zealand or for Saudi. But something just felt, we just had this feeling that we should do something sooner. So one morning I was reading, and I came across that verse, whatever you have in mind, do it, for God is with you. And that, you know, the fact that God was with us had sort of been building in my consciousness, in my mind. So I called Kate. I don't know why she wasn't there. She was across the town for some reason.
I was at an old house. Old house.
Oh, at the old house looking to see if the mail had come. And I said, hey, I just feel we should leave now. We're ready. Let's go. We don't have tickets or anything, but we should go. So she said she agreed. We sort of prayed about it. She agreed. So we decided we'd meet each other at the train station. So we took taxis or buses and got to the train station in the center of Newcastle. And just as we got there, the train that we were meant to get on was leaving. So we jumped on that train with all of our bags and off we went to London without any of the stuff we needed to leave. But we felt a sense of certainty about it, that God was going to look after us. So we arrived in London, and I remember we put some of our bags at, what's the station, the big train station in London called? King's Cross, yep. So we put some of our bags in storage there, and we carried with us, and we walked up one of the streets there in London, in the center of London, to the Saudi embassy. And just as we were walking, we took a taxi part of the way. As we were walking, I thought, oh no, I know what will happen. They will have mailed my passport back up to Gateshead, up to Newcastle, and we're here in London without a passport. But we walked into the embassy, and I think we hardly stopped at all. We went in, and as I was approaching the desk, I saw a lady come out. I said, do you have a passport for Robert McNaughton? She said, oh yes, just a minute. She went in, she grabbed the passport and handed it to me. We hardly had to stop at all. And I had my passport stamped with a Saudi visa. So we were feeling hopeful. And we'd already been feeling hopeful, but this was good. This was a move in the right direction. So we walked out of the Saudi embassy and walked along, I think it's Piccadilly, to New Zealand House. And I didn't know anything about New Zealand at the time, but there was a a tall security guard, probably Maori security guard, standing outside. And it was about 4:15 in the afternoon, and he said, "Oh, I wouldn't." He said, "It's hopeless. Basically, don't bother going in. You won't get your visa now. There's too many people in there." So we went upstairs to the room where everybody was waiting, and there was indeed a large crowd. But we thought, surely God is still going to do something. So I don't like to jump the queue. It's very rude to do so. But I saw a person, and I got her attention, and I said, "Hey, is there any, I've been talking to, I can't remember what the lady's name was, I've been talking to this lady about my passport. Do you think we could get my passport stamped for New Zealand now?" She said, "Let me see what I can do." And so she grabbed my passport, and 10 minutes later, we walked out of there with a visa for New Zealand as well. So it was going pretty well. So we were pretty stoked. We had our bags. We went back to the train station and got our bags. And the next step was to get on the tube and go to Heathrow Airport. So with all of our belongings, we got on the tube and off we went to Heathrow Airport. But remember, we still didn't have a ticket for that day. Our ticket was for 2 weeks' time. So we walked into, I think it was Emirates we were flying with. We walked into the Emirates desk. And I said to the lady, "Hey, listen, our ticket is for 2 weeks' time. Is there any chance that we could fly today?" And she said, "It's impossible, sorry." But we weren't feeling deterred. So we walked back outside, just outside the airport, and we prayed about it. We said, "God, you've got us this far. Already a number of things have happened that seem impossible, humanly speaking." So we went back inside, same desk, same lady, same group of ladies. We said, "You sure there's nothing that you can do?" She said, "Let me see." So she typed away in her computer, and in about 10 minutes' time, we had a flight for that day. So it was crazy the way it all worked out. And later on, you know, probably 10, 15 hours from that, we were at home with my parents in Saudi Arabia. But that confirmed to me, that experience confirmed to me that God is on our side. He's on our side. I know there's this passage in, I think it's to do with Joshua, where Joshua goes out with the armies of God and he meets somebody and he says, "Whose side are you on?" And the answer is, "No one's. You've got to be on my side." But I think in some very real way, God is also on our side when we believe and trust in him. And so that verse, "Whatever you have in mind, do it, for God is with you," really worked out well on that particular day and show me that God can make things work if you are trusting in him and if you love him. So Kate's turn.
So this verse is John chapter 3, verse 8. "The wind blows where it pleases. You hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it's going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit." This verse is really encouraging to us because sometimes if you're following Jesus, the way your life is going will make sense to everyone around you, but other times it really doesn't make sense to everyone around you. The first year we were married, I was really struggling through the challenges of my first year working as a doctor, feeling quite disillusioned about the profession I'd signed up for, people's attitudes, the way patients were treated, things that went badly wrong that didn't need to have gone wrong, and I didn't want to be a part of it anymore. I'd been given a job offer for the following year, but we'd have to move towns. Rab's job was changing to a different company. There was a lot of change, and it just felt like such a failure. You know, you've worked so hard to do something, tried so hard for so long, and you finally get there, and you don't want to do it anymore at all. At the time, it felt really scary not knowing what to do next, but looking back, I can really see God's provision in making us able to leave and taking us on to do other things. I don't think we would have been here in New Zealand if things had been going great, you know. Another time was when we decided to go live in Indonesia for a year. It was just after Nathan was born. And being at work and trying to explain to people what on earth we were trying to do, people were confused about what we were doing. People at church understood, and it was a really memorable year and a really good opportunity learning to trust God. Later, when we moved to Bluff, we discovered that's another place that people are surprised about. You can't say you live in Bluff without people asking you why. Don't know what that's about. We've been in Bluff 17 years now. I'd imagined when we moved back from New Zealand, moved back to New Zealand from living in a little Muslim neighborhood in Indonesia, that I was excited there'd be more Christians around, it would be easier. People would generally, even if they weren't Christians, most people would surely know most of the message. Really silly, I know. It turned out, of course, that the need in Bluff is just as big as it is in Jambi in Indonesia. there are a lot of people in New Zealand who still need to hear about God. I was surprised when we've been in Bluff, the number of kids who were really keen to come to after-school clubs or youth group, who hardly knew anything, who hadn't heard the Bible stories. There's no Bible in schools in Bluff. People just don't know. And how interested people often are. In our time in church in Bluff, it always felt quite thin on the ground, you know, when you're part of a small church. It was also a really good time. There are a few different stories I could tell you about all sorts of things, but just, I guess, the main message is how God provides and how he surprises us with what he does and how things fit together when you're not sure you have enough or you've quite got it in you to do anything. One of the times I was thinking of was when Ezra was newborn and we decided to start a Sunday school at church. There wasn't anything going on for kids. And people were really encouraging. One of the older ladies had a couple of grandkids who would like to come. There was another couple who had a toddler, and we had three kids under the age of, well, three and under. So I was just kind of worried because it didn't seem like a very exciting thing to invite this, you know, two grandkids to come to a bunch of babies. And on the morning, I wasn't expecting it, but a family from Oamaru who had eight children decided to come to church. And it was such a great celebration. It was Easter Sunday. There were a bunch of really enthusiastic kids, and these kids who'd come to church with their grandparent, they kept coming. They brought some friends. Things built up from there. And I just think God is so good. I also remember a particular time when we had a baptism of a good friend of mine who'd recently become a Christian. We decided to have the baptism out at Maui Beach. If you know Maui Beach, it's a beautiful place to go for a lovely deserted walk. There's usually nobody there. And it was a good day. We'd prayed for good weather. The sun was shining. The tide was right. We turned up at the beach on Sunday afternoon, and it was like the entire town of Bluff had decided to go to the beach. People had spread out picnic blankets at exactly the little bit that we decided to do the baptism. Nobody had invited them. They just sort of turned up for a Sunday afternoon picnic all independently. And my friend just handed out song sheets, and everyone's like, oh, cool, this is going on. This is an event. It was the most public baptism I have ever been to. And it still surprises me how God did that. More recently, it's been surprising to me that our time at the church in Bluff finished. I didn't see that coming. I'm really thankful that it did. I'm thankful for our years there. And I'm really thankful for the way God has provided for us to be here with you guys. Shall I read that last one?
Yeah, let's read it together.
All right. We thought we'd leave you with the passage from Psalm 145. We were talking about this psalm when we were over in the States doing a long road trip while we were visiting Rab's family. And we got to talking about different experiences and how God has protected us, provided for us, and allowed us to see the things that he is doing. We were talking about how important it is to tell the stories of what God has done in our lives and to remind ourselves and each other of his goodness, especially when things feel really boring or ordinary, remembering to try and see it through God's perspective and what we get to see him doing. So here's Psalm. So verse 3, 2, 8.
Great is the Lord, and most worthy of praise. His greatness no one can fathom. One generation commends your works to another. They tell of your mighty acts. They speak of the glorious splendor of your majesty, and I will meditate on your wonderful works. They tell of the power of your awesome works, and I will proclaim your great deeds. They celebrate your abundant goodness and joyfully sing of your righteousness. The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love. The Lord is good to all he has made. He has compassion on all he has made.